Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Emma Fraser.
And I'm Lillian Crawford.
On the show this week, Mrs. Harris packs up her bags and heads to Paris. It's a sensory explosion on Flux Gourmet. And on Film Club, it's grotesque gastro-satire, the cook, the thief, his wife and her lover. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, Emma, been only a few weeks since we last had you on. I very much appreciate all of the work of yours that I've been reading since, though, particularly your piece on the costumes of Go Revenge. That was a very delightful. Do Revenge or Go Revenge?
Do.
I really liked that, I must say. But yeah, your piece on the costumes was kind of a real cherry on top of the cake for me.
Yeah, no, that was a great conversation I had with Alana Moorehead. Like, it was one of those films as well. As soon as I saw the trailer, I was like, I need to talk to the costume designer because it was just such a candy explosion. It did all the nods to every teen movie I love growing up. And she was pretty much the same age as me. So when we talked, she's British as well. So it was really fun talking to another Brit about our influences and talking school uniform. And then, yeah, things like Olivia Colman, the bearded dragon, having her own wardrobe. That was a really fun detail. And that she was so easy to dress.
Well, I'm glad that we have you on for a week that has got some absolutely fantastic fashion going on. Like, do you have any highlights of the year?
Costume-wise,
yeah.
Oh no, this is one of those things where I'm now put on the spot. I mean, I've literally just done conversations with the Ariane Phillips, who did Don't Worry Darling. And I know obviously there's a lot of conversation about this movie, but the costumes are impeccable. Ariane Phillips is an icon. She did Once Upon a Time in America, in Hollywood, not America. And she did Walk the Line. She's worked with Madonna, Single Man. She's someone I've wanted to talk to for a long time, and the costumes in that I thought were top notch. And same with Blonde again, the costumes, even though the film is obviously controversial, the costumes I think nail the Marilyn look. So that's recency bias, but those two I would definitely say.
And Lillian, I wanted to talk to you about this thing that I've noticed you've been doing. You just hosted, is it called a relaxed screening at the BFI? I'm really curious about this. Like, what is it that entails?
Yeah, so I'm autistic, so I sometimes find being in the cinema environment quite distressing, and that's not uncommon for autistic people and people with different forms of neurodivergence. So we'd basically put on screenings that try to make that experience a little less overwhelming, keeping the volume down fairly low, keeping the lights on a level that's not complete darkness, that kind of thing. People making sure that everyone knows they can move around if they need to, or leave the cinema anytime there's a safe space for people to leave if it does get too much. So I did one on Monday at the BFI for Les Parapluies de Cherbourg, which was a really interesting... I didn't choose the film. I was sort of told that this is a film we were going to do. I was quite surprised because it's quite an overwhelming film, really. It's very intense in its emotion and style, but people responded to it really, really well, and we had a discussion afterwards. So yeah, I think with these things, they're fairly new, so it's just sort of learning from them, learning what people respond to, what people find too much, and trying to create a space that's safe for people of all forms of neurodiversity.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's kind of something that I hadn't really considered, that cinema environment can be incredibly stressful. I remember coming out and seeing you straight after Suicide Squad, which I think, you know, also you had a visceral hatred for that film, but it was like a really unpleasant experience on like many levels with how noisy and how crowded it was.
Yeah, definitely. It's something that I'm definitely sort of wary of going into London Film Festival next week, is sort of how overwhelming sort of those kinds of crowds can be, and the sorts of films that I choose to watch. But it's important to make people aware of this and make different cinemas aware of this and try to put on these kinds of programs.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to the Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris tells the story of a widowed cleaning lady in the 1950s who falls madly in love with a couture Dior dress and decides that she must now have one of her own. She embarks on an adventure to Paris, which will change not only her outlook, but the very future of the House of Dior. So, Emma, I feel that we've had so many bleak films of late, and I was so happy when I saw that that we had a kind of really heartwarming one coming up. But is Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, you know, a bit better than your just kind of regular twee feel-good movie?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, part of that is down to obviously Leslie Manville. She's always great. And it's interesting seeing her in a film about fashion and this period of fashion that's very different to Phantom Thread. Like, the opposite of Phantom Thread, pretty much. So, yeah, I do think that it does have the components of these kind of classic British twee movies that we're very, very good at. That sometimes you come out of them and you're like, oh, that was lovely, but I'm never going to think about it again. And I think probably because I am interested in the history of fashion and Christian Dior and that whole side of like couture, that it did have that element of like, I came out and I went straight to my books and I kind of nerded up again about Dior, and it just kind of hit every note for me.
And has this kind of got any like, you know, historical accuracy in terms of what was actually happening in the House of Dior in the 1950s, or is this kind of more fantasy?
I mean, there are elements that are accurate, like, so the kind of going into prêt-à-porter, as it was, so expanding from the haute couture element of the business. I mean, that's definitely something that was happening around then. And that year, actually, so 1957 is when Christian Dior died. He died suddenly in October of 1957 of a heart attack. And so it did throw the house into kind of a bit of a tumultuous time when Yves Saint Laurent took over at the age of 21, which is also a very fascinating story. So it has those elements of fantasy, but the stuff to do with the kind of strikes and that whole element did feel baked in reality.
Lillian, did this work for you? You seem to be someone who is, you know, a woman of great style. I'm wondering whether films about fashion are something that you generally connect to.
Yeah, hugely. I any film remotely related to fashion, I will watch. I remember the Christian Dior exhibition at the V&A a few years ago now, and I lost count of how many times I was going there. So seeing this film about someone who can't afford Dior dresses, should stress, but is absolutely enamored by them and absolutely, you know, sort of in love with them. It's very, very much something that I connected with. I did watch the 1992 TV version of this book, which is by Paul Gallico. It was quite a charming book, and there's a whole series of books about Mrs. Harris, as she's called, which had Angela Lansbury as Mrs. Harris and Diana Rigg as Isabelle Huppert's character in this version. So that's fun. and a sort of old Omar Sharif as the sort of love interest of Mrs. Harris, who sort of turns on her a little bit and sort of reminds her of her social positioning, even when everyone's sort of generally being lovely. Although the thing that I noticed in this one is that Isabelle Huppert is really mean, which is really funny. She's just, she is, it's very similar in many ways to Emily in Paris, which I find quite distressing. This is like the good version of Emily in Paris, because Mrs. Harris is so much nicer than Emily. The sort of overlap in casting as well. So Isabella Pear plays the sort of Sylvie type character in this, which I thought was a lot of fun. It's sort of her late career doing very silly movies rather than perhaps doing something that's actually a bit more serious.
Well, you know, Isabelle Huppert does have that kind of ability to be, like, I suppose, that kind of awful woman that you do feel you could destroy your life trying to impress. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. She's, I don't know, her performance in this reminded me a bit of Greta in some ways. When she's speaking in English, there's something quite sort of disconcerting about it, and the way that she sort of has this on-screen presence opposite Leslie Manville is very funny. But I thoroughly enjoyed that. I thought it was a fun dynamic. Yeah.
But Emma, like, so much of this film is about that, you know, it's about the dress, but it's also not about the dress. Like, do you think that it kind of did capture that this, you know, this isn't just about, you know, her wanting to look pretty in a gown?
Yeah, like, there's obviously a lot of talk about fairy tales in the film, and the fact that she is a widower, it's post-war Britain, it's 1957, so it is a decade after the war is finished, but you can still see the effects of that. And the fact that she does have this job where she gets to see these kind of things, like, she's working for rich people, she gets to see garments like that. So it's like you can be that close to something and not experience it. And it's less about the material side of it and more about the fantasy. Like, when she goes into the atelier and she sees the courtiers making the clothes, and she's like, you captured moonlight, and you kind of feel like that. I also went to that V&A exhibition, and to see those clothes, people think fashion is frivolous, and it can be, it is frivolous, but it is also capturing art in clothing. And I think this movie does a really good job of getting to why something like spending £500 on a dress back then, like, it is more than about the money.
Yeah, I was kind of slightly surprised. I didn't know any, I mean, I know that this has existed as a book and as a play, but I didn't know anything really coming into it. That there's like, Lillian, how did you find the kind of class warfare side of things?
That side of things is quite messy. I'm not, those boundaries aren't really drawn very clearly. And it is quite funny how sort of she tries to engage, I say she doesn't really try it. The model character Natasha and the accountant at Dior are sort of always talking about Sartre, which is just really funny. And she says, they go to like the Folies Bergère, and she says about nosy, and then it turns out to be Le Nausé, and it's such a strange sort of class divide. But then at the end of it, she sort of leads them in this strike action, and there is a certain sort of class awareness going on. Yeah, I don't know, it feels messy, but it's interesting, I would say.
Emma, did that side of things work for you, the kind of larger societal ills being manifested between Leslie Manville and what is she called, the woman who's playing her boss, who was in Four Weddings and a Funeral? I've forgotten her name, but she's got a kind of monstrous
Anna Chancellor.
Yes, Anna Chancellor.
Yeah,
it's a kind of monstrous aristocratic boss.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff, like, yeah, it is kind of messy, and it is very surface level. And there's obviously stuff throughout as well about how rich people can't pay their bills. And the fact that being wealthy means that you take advantage of people around you. You don't pay for things when you say you will. So I thought that stuff was interesting from a surface level point of view. I think it isn't going too deep. And then the strike action as well, it's all very again, fairy tale. It is a fairy tale. So that side doesn't feel particularly real, but I think I got swept up in it in the moment.
Yeah, it does seem that there's kind of a rare British subgenre of kind of feel-good comedies in which there are also strikes. I wonder whether that says something about kind of the British character, that these are things that we put together.
I guess it's like a sense of you want the working class to rise up, and it seems like a lovely idea. And then sadly, when we see what's going on in the news with, you know, the financial crisis and cost of living issues, it's a nice daydream that doesn't match reality. And I wonder if that's also why we're good at it, because it happens quite frequently, you know, whether the 80s with the miners' strike, and there's obviously movies about that that are told from like a very rosy perspective, but with like an undercurrent of grit. So I wonder if it's just filmmakers grappling with the reality, but in this like Hollywoodified way.
Yeah, it almost feels like kind of we can't allow something to just be lovely, like that would kind of almost be you know, a little bit too brazen or something. But you know, for me, the kind of elements of this that worked best were the bits that were unashamedly trying to make you feel good and tell a lovely story and have a woman who's had so many difficulties in her life just get a win.
Yeah
definitely. It would be nice to see it. There is a musical version. I'd like to see that done as a film. Do it like Funny Face or something. That would be amazing.
Oh, well, hopefully not with all of the dramas that have recently gone on where they tried to put Funny Face on Broadway. But yeah, Lily, you said that you've revisited this several times since you first saw it. Why was that?
I don't know. It just really moves me. I think especially sort of, as you were saying, there's been a lot of bleak films and there's been a lot of bleakness in this country recently, that this is the first film that's really sort of made me feel very happy in a while. So it was quite nice to be able to just watch it and cry with happiness.
Wow. Thank you to
Anthony
so Fabian. Sad. No, thank you to Anthony Fabian for this life rope as we sail on our sea of despair. We should probably get some scores on this. Emma, do you want to go first? In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect.
So anticipation, I was at 4, you know, knowing that Leslie Manville plus Dior plus Jenny Bevan doing the costume, she's probably going to get another Oscar nomination for this. She won this year for Cruella, and she's obviously won for Mad Max before. So yeah, 4 for anticipation, 4 for enjoyment. I had a good time, cried a bit, laughed, enjoyed the fashion, and then 4 for the same retrospect, because again, I love Dior, I love costume design, so this has everything that I want. Basically, it's a feel-good movie, doesn't go too deep, and yeah, does exactly what it says it's gonna do.
I didn't realize this was the same woman who did the costumes for Mad Max. I love it when she wins an Oscar. I'm kind of a bit of an awards ceremony watcher, which I feel a lot of shame around. But I love it when she wins an Oscar, because she's always just in a denim jacket, you know, in old jeans and a kind of leather jacket. And it's so fascinating that somebody cares so much about fashion, but then also kind of is happy to just express themselves and not go with the status quo of the event.
Yeah, and the thing she tends to wear to these to Oscars as well, it tends to be in relation to the movie she's nominated for, so she kind of dresses the theme, which I love. So there was like kind of whole like Vivian Westwood vibe for Cruella, Mad Max she went with the leather. So yeah, she kind of dresses theme, and she's been nominated 11 times now, so she's definitely a favorite of the Academy, and for a good reason.
Well, I mean, they are getting increasingly unbearable, but maybe I will watch this year's again just in the hope that I can see her. Lillian, what about you? In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I'm exactly the same scores as Emma. 4s across the board with this one. As I say, I've already rewatched several times and will almost certainly continue to do so. Might actually get to see it in a cinema, which would be lovely. I'd like to take my family to see it. It's the sort of film that's nice to, would be nice to watch with other people. I think it's going to do. I hope it does very well. I think it will cheer up a lot of people. And what more can you want from cinema?
Well, slightly more in my case, because my scores are going to be a little cooler. Probably 3 in anticipation, 4 in enjoyment, and 3 and in retrospect. Like, I think it was perfectly lovely, but maybe it kind of compared to all the other feel-good British strike movies, it kind of, the politics side of it just felt a little bit almost like twee to me. Like, you know, when people make poverty twee and you're just like, well, what kind of purpose is this really serving? Your heart's in the right place, but I don't know that this is, you're giving this the weight that it fully deserves. But yes, yeah, still, I would recommend it to many people and have already texted my grandmother to look out for it at her local cinema. Next up, Flux Gourmet.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Set in an institute devoted to culinary and alimentary performance, a collective finds itself embroiled in power struggles, artistic vendettas, and gastrointestinal disorders. So Lillian, Peter Strickland, generally a bit of a Marmite film director, did you come into this as a fan?
Yeah, very much so. Duke of Burgundy is one of the best films ever made. I would say that quite firmly. And I like his other films. I like Barbarian Sound Studio a lot. But I think that what was so striking seeing the trailer for this film was that it looked like Barbarian Sound Studio. I wasn't really sure going into it what he was doing differently this time, which is a film all about sort of using food to create sounds and this sort of sensory experience. He's very interested in a very tight sort of sensory awareness of the sounds that different fabrics make, different objects make, which, as I was saying earlier, as an autistic person, is very sort of heightened and something I'm very aware of in all aspects of my life. So maybe there's something to be made of Peter Strickland's style and aesthetic from an autistic perspective. I was really looking forward to it, and I think it was largely met by that level of expectation. I'm really interested in performance art generally, particularly sort of women using their bodies within performance art, people like Carolee Schneeman and Marina Abramovich. So seeing this was really interesting, and the inclusion of food was quite strange to me. It's not something I'm not sure I can sort of pinpoint what precisely the references there, or if it's trying to create something completely new with this style of food. I think sometimes it reminded me a little bit of this piece that Damien Hirst did based on Samuel Beckett's Breath, which had like all of these sort of cigarette butts in like surgical trays and bits of food and stuff like lying out. And there are scenes in this film that feel like installation pieces themselves that are set up in that way. That does sort of, it's those moments, those really artistic moments that I really love about his films, and that it all sort of homages that Strickland does, like to Stan Brakhage with the moths in Duke of Burgundy. It's he's very much a filmmaker who is trying to sort of question the sort of limits of what different forms of art are, and whether or not performance art can be brought into cinema, that it's not something that you're actually interacting with as an audience. These kinds of questions really fascinate me. So I think that that was something that he does really effectively in this film.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly is the case. And I could see kind of strangely a lot of parallels with Crimes of the Future in kind of exploring that. But to me, I kind of felt like I couldn't ever fall into a rhythm of the tone, maybe, of this film. Like, Emma, did you feel that you were on the same page of it? I'm kind of giving him a bit of a, I have to say, I was ill. So it's possible that was a factor. So, you know, I wouldn't kind of take that as being too damning an indictment. But yeah, Emma, did that kind of work for you? Because it's quite funny, I suppose, but it is also quite self-serious.
Yeah, the tone, I mean, this is my first Peter Strickland film as well. So I'd wanted to see it in Fabric and I just never got around to it. So yeah, this was my first experience and it's been a while since I've seen a film of this kind of style. So I think, I also was a bit ill and I've also had acid reflux the last week. So it felt very, like, I was like, this is really stressful because it's reminding me that I also have acid reflux. So I think I did enjoy the kind of weird tonal shifts, but at points I was a bit like, what are you trying to say here? Is this all satire against people who are trying to control the arts? Like the Jan Stevens character who, I mean, I love Gwendolyn Christie and that was my favorite performance in the film. And I was kind of just trying to work out what her role, like what that was trying to signify. So I had various ideas, but I was also like, am I reaching here? It's one of those films I think that makes you question your kind of perspective and whether you're seeing things that aren't there or not.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly has got many like spectacular moments in where we are kind of looking at the performances themselves. Like Lillian, did you think that that was something that he's able to capture, like the kind of what a live performance of something like that would be?
Yes, I mean, I think this is partly what I'm driving towards in my conception of the film and how successful it is that I think that the film itself is asking how successfully you can put performance art behind a camera with a camera of filming it, and that happens within the film itself with people taking photographs of what's going on and the way that you sort of preserve these very live performances. What's so interesting is that there's a very clear that barrier exists within the performance art itself. That's not often the case with forms of performance art, but there would be some kind of use of the audience within those installation pieces that I don't think that the film really taps into. But then of course the fact that it's a residency and it's actually lived in is that the whole thing ends up sort of becoming this piece of performance art, and that there is an element of satire to it which I thought was very effective, although there is always this sort of issue with mocking the sort of pretentiousness of certain aspects, the sort of the wealthy person who's investing in these things and the way that people are sort of responding to that, in this case by throwing terrapins through windows into soup, is I don't know if that's as clear of what where there's a certain sort of almost Benwellian critique of social structure, of people sort of sat around lavish dinner tables and things, and hints of a certain uprising, but actually it's just coming from sort of other jealous artists. So I found it very funny. I think it's a very funny film, but I also think it's very beautiful and uses those artistic elements in a really interesting way that I think it was questioning a specific form of artistic creation that I don't remember seeing in a film for quite a while that I found really engaging.
Yeah, no, I am with you. I thought a lot of the kind of moments of humour really like punched through for me, and particularly the terrapins. And I love, you know, that whole, the art world for, you know, what I know of it, those rivalries are kind of so funny in many respects, of everybody just kind of accusing everybody else of being you know, overly pretentious and, you know, not really self-reflective. But like, I suppose where it lost me was that I didn't see much being built upon that. Like once we've kind of, you know, seen this premise, we've kind of had a few laughs, we've sort of seen the wild and weird things that people are doing, it just kind of I don't think it really like built upon that for me.
No, it's interesting. I don't know. I think that there is a certain mockery towards the, I mean, I won't spoil where it's sort of building towards, but there is a certain sort of parallel drawn between the use of the food in the art and the impact of food on the body and the way that the body responds to that, and a certain catharsis that can be brought about through artistic creation. I don't know. I think the performances were really wonderful as well. I think that's something, I mean, you mentioned Gwendolyn Christie, but Ariane Labed and Fatma Mohammed as this sort of artistic collective duo who are sort of these brilliant almost pastiches of previous era of performance art, just sort of chain smoking and floating around the grounds of the house. I thought they were astonishing, and the way that they sort of blend the art into how they actually live as people was really fascinating. Not so sure why Asa Butterfield is here in this film. Maybe that's a criticism, that he does feel slightly out of place.
He felt like he was in like maybe like a Christopher Guest film, whilst everybody else was doing something a little more subtle. But what about for you, Emma? Were there any kind of like standout people or moments for this film?
I've mentioned Gwendolyn Christie already, and I will obviously point out the costume design again because it's my thing. So her costumes were designed by her boyfriend, who's Giles Deacon, the fashion designer.
I love that power couple.
Yeah, he didn't do the whole film, and Saffron Culane did the costumes for everyone else. But I loved Gwendolyn Christie's, like, it was like a mixture of masculine and feminine, like those huge skirts, like the organza skirts with these tight kind of tailored jackets and ruffles, and it was visually like extraordinary to look at, and every time she came on screen I was just excited to see what she was wearing. In terms of performances, I thought the, and I'm gonna forget his name, the journalist who's not a journalist, who's a hack,
he says that he's a hack, but he actually seems like a pretty good journalist to me.
Right. Exactly. And I love that kind of whole high art versus low art conversation, the fact that the doctor kept being like, you don't know who this person is, you haven't read this person. So I like those kind of like dichotomies between the high and the low, and like who gets to decide what you should have read to be considered like a writer. So I thought those aspects worked really well in terms of the overall message, or what I thought the overall message of the film was. But yeah, I mean, visually, even in the really gross parts that were maybe like I didn't want to particularly be looking at, even those were like beautifully shot, I thought.
Well, we should get some scores on this. Lillian, you're probably going to be the most positive, so let's start on a high note.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, Strickland is one of my favourite directors, so I'd say a 5 going into this. So, although a trepidatious 5, because I was slightly struck by the apparent similarities to Bavarian Sound Studio. I'd say 4 for enjoyment then. Maybe saying that there are aspects that are slightly confused within the film, that sometimes there's these tonal shifts, as you said, that sort of pull you slightly out of it, but then 5 in retrospect, because I think what it's saying about art and what it's doing about art, particularly modes of performance, and also it's very queer, I should point that out. There's a good level of queerness in this film that I thoroughly enjoyed and expect from Strickland. So I think that I think that's where I'm sort of sitting on it now.
Wonderful. Emma, what about you?
I probably went in at a 4. I'd heard about Peter Strickland. I was excited to see my first Peter Strickland movie. The poster was intriguing. Then the actual film, probably a 3, just because I did find it at times, I wasn't entirely sure what it was trying to say and the tonal shifts. But there were really striking moments as well. And then probably 3 in retrospect, again, because there were elements that I really liked and performances that I enjoyed, but it probably isn't going to stay with me for a very long time.
Probably 3s across the board for me. As much as I have really liked a lot of Strickland's last films, I don't know, somehow the description of this sounded like a bit unbearable. then, yeah, I would say 3 in enjoyment, 3 in retrospect. But again, very unreliable 3. I was taking a lot of cough medication and was very exhausted. And I think now I might have to give it a go after Lillian kind of has praised it so much, because we rarely entirely disagree. Up next, Film Club. The cook, the thief, his wife and her lover. At La Hollandaise gourmet restaurant, every night is filled with opulence, decadence and gluttony. But when a cook, a thief, his wife and her lover all come together, they unleash a shocking torrent of sex, food, murder and revenge. So, Emma, another feast for the costume eyes. But was this your first time watching this film?
It was my first time watching this film. I had to buy it on DVD just because that was the way that it seemed available. Also, I end up, I do love physical media. So I think I got to see the full version because it was 2 hours long. So mm-hmm. I think I got to see it's an 18 certificate. So yeah, my first time experiencing this film, as soon as I saw Jean-Paul Gaultier's name in the opening credits as doing the costume design, I let out a cheer. And Michael Nyman, the composer as well, who did the score, is another favorite of mine, so that was also exciting. The actual film was an intense watch. I don't think I was quite prepared for what exactly unfolded. From that opening scene, though, you kind of know that it's going to be going to some very dark places. So, yeah, it was another food, sex, extravaganza of, like, grotesque elements and, yeah, fully wild experience.
Yeah, I first came to this at university, and I went through this period of about 4 years of, like, that three men insisted on showing this film to me. I don't know why, but like I have a almost kind of Pavlovian response to be like, ow. I feel like I'm on a bad date when it starts. But it's a wonderful film. I am able to kind of eventually look past that. But Lillian, was it also your first time with this, or are you already a fan of Peter Greenaway?
No, this is my first time watching it, which is frankly embarrassing for someone who is very interested in this kind of cinema, and particularly in this kind of British cinema. It's one of my grandmother's favourite films. She's always talked about this film since I was very little, and has always said that you must watch The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover, because it's one of the best things ever made, which is probably not the best thing to say to like an 8-year-old. It's probably a good thing that my parents wouldn't let me see it until I was quite a lot older. I remember seeing Peter Greenaway talking on a television broadcast. It must have been at the BAFTAs or something. I know he won a Lifetime Achievement Award, and he said that the great thing about being a film director is that you get to put your sexual fantasies and fetishes up on screen. So I'd always thought that this film was going to be like very fetishistic and very sexual, but it's like really quite horrific. It's a very intense and graphic film. There's sexual elements to it. Helen Mirren spends a lot of time doing that in cubicles in the restaurant with the lover, but yeah, I can see why my grandmother recommended it to me. It's very much sort of, she also loves Derek Jarman and Jarman's films, and that kind of like just taking like a warehouse and filling it with colour and vibrancy and great costumes is just mind blowing to me. This whole world is so fascinating and so rich. That's clearly inspired Peter Strickland's films. Like Flux Gourmet is very clearly inspired by the use of lighting, the use of color, the use of costume, as I say. And then there's also this kind of like Jacobean aspect to it that I find really fascinating, the use of John Ford's 'Tis Pity She's a Whore as the sort of basis for the plot, and the way that he twists that at the ending, which I won't ruin for people who haven't seen the film, because it has one of the best endings I think I've ever seen, and the way it builds on that using with Michael Nyman's sort of march from Memorial Building incredibly loudly is just so good. It feels like the end of like a John Webster play or something from that period of theatre that I just really, really love and really, was completely overwhelmed by.
Yeah, it's such an incredible thing, because so many just moments, if you just press pause, would like warrant framing. like he's really got that whole thing of composition and shadow and like building to that kind of Baroque Renaissance style, and like doing it with quite wild abandon. It seems crazy to me that when this film came out, it was, you know, the censors really came for it. It was basically given the same rating as if it had been pornography. But that's not to say that it isn't quite a shocking, upsetting film. Like, Emma, did you find it quite disturbing, a lot of what happens?
I mean, that I mentioned the opening scene being quite confrontational, and it does kick the movie off to a point where you're like, oh, nothing after this is going to be that surprising, even though there are horrific things that happen later, particularly things to do with books that I won't spoil. So I think it lets you know exactly what it is from that opening scene. And like I said, when I got the DVD, I was like, oh, this is an 18 certificate. I wonder if it's going to be like an old style 18 where it would be a 15 now, but I actually think it would still be an 18 just because of the violence, less so the sexual element, because those scenes are kind of, they're not funny, but they're less about the eroticism, I would say. The fact that, you know, there are people just walking in, having conversations in the kind of like the kitchen area. So the sex scenes don't feel like the reason why it's so like an X rating or an 18 as it is now. So yeah, I think in those terms as to how people responded to it, I get it, because it was 1989, but in comparison to what we see now, it doesn't feel particularly outrageous.
Yeah, I think perhaps also what has shifted when we're watching it now is that kind of, you know, Michael Gambon and Helen Mirren and Tim Roth, who's got a small part in this, is such kind of like titans of the British industry that like it feels immediately like incredibly classy, I suppose.
Yeah, I can see that. And also, Helen Mirren, can we just say, I mean, ageism in Hollywood and stuff, she still looks the same. I mean, obviously, yeah. But it's insane that this movie is like 1989, and it looks like she could have been like 10, 15 years ago. And so that, and whereas Michael Gambon looks like an entirely different person. Like, if I didn't know it was Michael Gambon, I might have just been like, who is this guy? But yeah, I think there is that element of prestige. Those names are people we attach such significance to in the British film industry. So I think that perhaps, yeah, viewing it through a contemporary lens makes it different. I will say that some of the domestic violence stuff does feel jarring in comparison to maybe when it came out. I mean, I can't say how people felt in 1989 about those things, but that stuff felt particularly nauseating to me.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of the depiction, I'm a food person, I worked in food for many years, and a lot of the depictions of food are very unappetizing for a film that's kind of so concerned with it. But Lillian, I imagine as a vegan, a lot of it must have been quite tough.
Oh yeah, I mean, like, gagged several times watching this film, especially at the ending. I think that the way that that's all crafted is just astonishing. Michael Gambon, as you say, is stupendously good in this film. This must be the best thing he's ever done. I need to watch more old Michael Gambon performances, but he's so horrible. I cannot stress how awful he is in this film. I think a lot of films about sort of mobsters and gang, well, not, you know, there's sort of mob type films that's often American rather than British. There are a lot of British sort of mob films, but the fact that the wife is so big within that, that her role and the sort of her ability to sort of use her own power and actually sort of rise above that is, to me, so much more interesting than the majority of like mafia films, for example, like Scorsese's films that I always just fall asleep during because there is no interesting female presence within those films whatsoever, whereas it's very strong in this film. And just in terms of the aesthetic, as you were saying about like the food and the It's so interesting that Jean-Paul Gaultier does do the costumes, because I kept thinking of like Genet's films like City of Lost Children, which Gaultier also did the costumes for, and that kind of influence that this film has had on later films, and particularly on people like Genet and Strickland is really interesting to see, and to ground it again back in very old art, as you were saying. There's a massive banquet painting by Franz Hals on the wall of the restaurant, and Greenaway is fascinated by people like Rembrandt and Van Dyck, the sort of Flemish art of the Baroque. So it's the way that that's sort of infused into the film itself feels so much more interesting on an aesthetic level than a lot of attention is paid to, I think, perhaps to maybe a bigger budget film might do to that kind of composition, which, as you said, Layla can just sort of be framed at every single point within the film.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It kind of coming back to it after maybe 10 years since I saw it last, it's kind of no less striking, because I think each rewatch there's sort of a new little detail to pick out on when, you know, it comes to even Gambon's performance is somehow ages gets better every time, because it just seems so impossible that you're so foul and kind of boorish, but then like grand as well. Like he's kind of bringing it to it what feels like a Shakespearean performance, but whilst being so kind of, you know, what I can think of is scummy. But yeah, Emma, would you any last thoughts on the thief, his wife, and her lover before we wrap up?
Yeah, I just want to mention the kind of marriage between costume production, design, and the cinematography, because the color, the way the different rooms impact the way the costumes change color, mm-hmm. was like, for a film that's so grotesque, that element was so delightful. It was visually interesting throughout, and I love this kind of intense white bathroom. Like it felt kind of Kubrickian in a way, yeah. Maybe different bathrooms in Kubrick because of The Shining. So it had that kind of, like, you know, it was just so much fun. I've never wanted to go back to a bathroom so as much as this, basically. And just because, yeah, the costumes do change color depending on what room they're in. It's just a really fascinating idea that I don't think I've ever seen anyone do before. I would like to see it again, to be honest.
Yeah, as a gimmick, you'd think you'd get sick of it, but like you're still kind of like final act every time it happens. You're like, yay! Which is, I mean, you shouldn't really say yay at a film with such incredibly dark themes, but but you know, I have to say to all the film bros that I met at university who kept showing me this film, you have impeccable taste. Right. If you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, Viola Davis reigns as the Woman King. We travel to a surreal planet inhabited only by women in After Blue. And in Film Club, Sean Connery is the man who would be king. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Layla Latif, and my guests this week were Lillian Crawford and Emma Fraser. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Jake Cunningham.